Welcome back, everyone. This is Simon Phillips and The Change Show. We're going to be talking about something today that I think is going to prompt a lot of conversation in your house this week. So definitely got a brilliant guest for you today that is thinking about things that we sort of know intuitively are going on in the background, but he's done a lot of research and a lot of investigation into this topic, and I know you're going to love it. So it's a great pleasure to introduce you to Steve Sanders from Business Growth Mechanics. Morning, Steve. How are you doing?
Hi, Simon. Good morning. I'm very well, thank you. Very good to be with you this morning. Yeah.
Excellent. So, Steve, tell us a little bit about yourself for the audience at home.
So, I've been working in strategy and go-to-market for a couple of decades. Led very large-scale go-to-market transformations for some of the big IT companies and telcos, and also turnaround and business unit turnaround and major program turnaround. Typically, the sort of work that I've done over the years has been where there's a big shift required in the way of thinking, in the way of going about business. So I tend to be a person that's available in organizations to come in and figure out how to do things radically differently. Not cleverer than the other people, just focused differently. Because a lot of people are focused on the as is. And they've often asked me to focus on where things have to move to. So I've had the great privilege of sharpening my mind around where things are moving to, where the puck is moving to, if you like, in the great game of our business world.
Excellent. And have you done that across multiple sectors, or have you specialized in certain areas?
Yeah, well, I've touched on financial services, telecoms, pharmaceuticals, life sciences, agri sciences. I come from the IT industry originally, but by virtue of that, arguably all companies are technology companies now, no matter what they do, or they are becoming primarily technology companies. So we've had a great opportunity in our sector to get involved in lots of different industries. And of course, working for Ernst & Young most recently before becoming independent, that gave me also a great opportunity to do some really interesting strategic level things with major organizations and ecosystems.
Brilliant. So, Steve, take us back. Where did it all start? At what point did you wake up and think, I want to be an IT program manager? What's the origin story?
Well, the program manager sounds very too much boring for me. sorry, all the program managers. I entered the IT industry a long time ago with IBM, before IBM actually. But the big interesting stuff was with IBM, and it was there that I learned doing a project for Lou Gerstner, who was the global lead at that point, to re-engineer the go-to-market approach in the mid-market. And it gave me a chance to do things, you know, very experimentally, to use new channels, new partnerships with software vendors, new ways of bundling value propositions within the business and creating, huge amounts of income from doing things kind of differently to the way the core model did it. And it was at that point that I thought, hold on, I'm achieving a lot more growth here than I could have done as a salesperson going out and selling stuff. I'm thinking differently about the business goals of clients. I'm thinking differently about how we make money. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it gave rise to this sort of, it was a dawning moment for me, really. It gave rise to a completely different outlook on what I should be doing in business. I wasn't going to use my efforts anymore just banging on doors and pushing harder at the black and white objectives that I'd been set. I was going to look at an ecosystem and think, how do I create as much value as possible in that ecosystem, and how do I make as much profit from that as an organization? And that stayed with me, and that's basically was the formative period of my life. And I've taken that through times at Hewlett Packard, where I launched the services business. I've taken it through times at BT Global Services, leading turnaround on major programs in government and healthcare, and transformation of the global sales force. And I had clients in various industries when I was independent before joining EY, where I helped them refocus, moving from product-led to solutions and services that was in telco, in banking and payment services, and you know, in various markets. Yeah. And it was it's an exciting place to be. When I looked at what I was to leave as a mark as an author, I decided that that I could see something happening in the world that maybe I could notice this and I could give structure to it in ways that I wasn't seeing around me. I wasn't seeing other people dealing with it in the way that I thought this needs to be viewed in a very specific way in order to make good use of the opportunity, in order not to let this disruption pass us by without leveraging it positively. Yeah,
and I know we're going to be coming back to your new book in a moment or two. I just want to go back to the time when you were working inside the likes of IBM and Hewlett Packard. So big, massive organizations that have, what makes them successful is their ability to structure the work that they're doing, to systemize the activity. So when you're going in there and saying, let's think about or rethink our whole approach to a marketplace, you're effectively trying to orchestrate change on two levels. You've got the internal desire, if you like, to push through a new way of working, a new way of thinking about things. So there's those stakeholders to deal with. And then you've got the external marketplace to go and influence and try to think in different ways. So how did you navigate that?
The main reason I got involved in things was because often even the internal stakeholders didn't understand what they were biting off. Yeah. Right. And although there was a stated desire to move in a new direction or to do something more ambitious or to move into a space where arguably the organization might not have been qualified and competent to be in that space, they still wanted to do it. So there was another level in there as well, which was not just the perceptions of the market around you and other organizations in your ecosystem that were saying, you don't do that, right? That's not what we expect from you. And I'm not going to use any specific company names, because it's really quite damning, actually, hear what they were experimenting with that they'd never done before.
I would imagine it's going to be a similar experience in each of these organizations that you've been.
Oh gosh, it is.
Yeah. There's such a routine way of doing things.
Well, yeah, that's right. They become large because they are creating critical mass around specific specialized areas, and that's what you do when you get big. You can't be nuanced and subtle and all that when you are 100,000 people, right? So you have to end up creating silos with processes that the people in those silos are there because they enjoy working that way, right? So when you approach them first off and you say, well, in order to achieve the aspirations that these leaders are articulating, you guys are going to have to do things very differently. And the inertia and the resistance that exists there, it exists because you're threatening something at a very human level, at a very biological level. You're asking them to break habitual ways of working that they feel comfortable and easy with. And even if you're doing that so that they can keep their jobs 2 years down the line, and I knew this, and it was always the same, actually, at least a good percentage of the workforce would be out of work, right, in a couple of years if they didn't make this shift. Yeah. It was pretty urgent for these at an individual human level. And it taught me how the forces of denial and resistance are seemingly out of place, but they are very fierce and very resilient. So you have to engage people at a different level to bring them along on their journey and accept that there is going to be a very small percentage that are leaning in the direction of saying, yeah, I'll play with that. Yeah, I'll maybe be your exemplar and the one that we will show the way. There is going to be a guy or a girl in there who is a huge denier, a huge resistor. But if you win them over, then that person can become your greatest champion. And because everybody's watching that person saying, if they move, I'll move, right? So there's all these dynamics that you've got people who are depleting your energy and people who are building your energy. And you need to find those builders and find the depleters and try and get those people pulling in the right direction for you. Then, of course, the market around that organization is often tuned into those people anyway. Right? So you're in a sense building up the energy, the positive energy in the direction of your change initiative. Sometimes the big customers, the end organizations that you're trying to deal with are also, should have a vested interest in the success of this change, but they have the similar resistance patterns. And what I've found is often the case is that you through a process of gaining trust and choosing where you want to establish that trust, you kind of ask them to allow you as an individual the latitude to make steps and move them in the right direction without necessarily committing to whole scale change, but just let's witness these little incremental changes as we go until they all start to make sense and we all start to agree on the assembly of these different increments. And it is a very human thing, and this is what we lose sight of when change initiatives affect whole markets or affect very large organizations. You lose sight of the fact that you're dealing with human beings. Yeah. And human beings gather together in groups of maybe 30, 40, 50 that they can assimilate to one another, and they associate tightly as a group. And unless you are making these initiatives and these the drivers of change relatable to those groups and those sizes of groups at an individual human level, you're not going to succeed. So this is how I learned to view these programs and these projects, and it helped me. So when I look at the big world around us today and there's things happening in the world around us, people do intellectually understand the need to change their buying patterns, the need to change the way their organization's supply chain works, but they're not doing anything about it yet, and it's because they haven't felt the threat or the impact at a human level to their immediate group. And it's, however, it is getting to the point where these global scale issues will start to affect people at the level of their immediate circle. And I think that's when you'll start to see the waking up moment, the tipping point where people will go, whoa, I can't believe I was buying products from that company that wraps in plastic. I cannot believe I was doing that. I feel so stupid. I'm going to find a company that doesn't.
You're describing there with those incremental changes that you're navigating, if you like, with those stakeholder groups, it is that sort of continuous improvement. How do you then get them to make the leap? Because for transformation to happen, there's got to be a shift in so many fundamentals. So we've seen, for example, in the last few years, a transformation in work patterns, mm-hmm. forced initially by the pandemic, but now embraced across so many organizations in terms of virtual working, etc. But that could not happen. I mean, there's been a lot of work done in the last decade to try to get organizations to incrementally shift, and it just didn't work fundamentally. So how did you create the energy for a transformational shift?
Well, I think that the pandemic was a tipping point event, or a tipping point affecting event that was waiting to happen. If it wasn't the pandemic, it would have been something else. And it's the absence of those, the critical mass of energy of various events. It's the absence of that that prevents people from reaching the point where there will be a big shift in behavior. So what the pandemic did was just an accelerator that was long overdue. Mm. And the frustration of people that were involved in agile working and flexible working promotions over the years is that there was so much common sense behind doing it this way. And yet the human level inertia that existed, we always do it that way, a good old handshake, that's the way we do it. It reminds me of this sort of phrase that I use, I shovel coal. Shoveling coal is what I do. It makes me sweaty, it makes me tired, I get covered in black dust, but I shovel coal. Don't talk to me about electricity, this newfangled stuff. I shovel coal, right? Mm. And actually it's that sort of nature of thing. You have to almost accept that there are two planes of change going on, or two planes of organization going on around this change journey. One is a structured intellectual level strategy that we can establish, and we imagine that we have control over that change. But there's also the need to respect the fact that there's a certain organic movement happening. And the organic movement is far too much controlled by chaos and by too many variables for us to actually understand how to tweak all of those variables. Mm. However, if we believe that the change journey, the destination of change, is the right destination, there's a certain amount of inevitability about that outcome. It's then just a question of the timing, right? It's a question of whether the energy builds quickly or gradually. And you could say that around the environmental and sustainability movement, the change might appear to be making a lot of noise now, but that's been going on since the 1960s. Yeah. Right? That, can you imagine being on the inside of that change movement and how frustrating that must feel, right? But so there's been a lot of very small organic things contributing towards all of these major changes. And it's, you know, if you fall into the camp of opinion that believes that everything needs to be controllable and everything needs to be orchestrated according to a master plan by a great genius, then you will believe that the solution to all of these problems sits in the hands of a few hundred people around the world who are prime ministers and presidents. And they are the great geniuses of the whole great leadership positions. I don't trust them that much. Obviously, you can't believe that source of great leadership and is going to come from geniuses in government, and then on the other hand criticize them for having no intelligence whatsoever. So you can't believe in that. You have to believe in the accumulated energy of all of the stakeholders that all see the common sense and the desirability of an outcome. Yeah. And it boils down to what you can do and how you can distribute messages and distribute triggers and distribute movement causing projects or work streams among those stakeholders that will activate their energy in the direction that you want. Unless you deal with it at a human level and at an orchestrated enterprise or market-wide level, and you make these two things meet, and you your structured side respects the inherently unstructured nature of human beings, and your unstructured humanistic side of things respects the need to map it into the structure at the top, unless you get that, you're going to lose out on a lot of the tools and weapons that you have at your disposal for achieving these outcomes.
So in introducing your book, then, was it a gradual awakening on your behalf that there is this uncatalogued series of events that we need to be paying attention to? Or was there a eureka moment where you just suddenly thought, do you know what? This is what I need to do next.
I think I'm an ethical capitalist, and I'm a when I saw this idea of stakeholder capitalism being discussed, and I saw very clever people engaged in the discussion, and creating flowcharts. And I don't know what you would call them. I opened a document one day, and it was about 250 little bubbles connected by lots of lines. And this chap was described, it was a German guy. Surprise, surprise, sorry. very intelligent bloke, very well structured, very academic. And it was impossible to understand. And I'm not a dummy, okay? I can understand pretty complex ideas. And what I saw in front of me was the issue. That is, that we've seen people banging their drum about environmental causes for years. I myself have been involved in a small startup to help a company in Cambodia to make fashion accessories and export them to the UK. And they use upcycled material in creating those products. So it's almost zero waste type of product. So I've had an interest in these sort of themes over time, but I've noticed the inability for mainstream adoption, for the mainstream to really gobble up these ideas. And I think we're overcomplicating it. And I really think that that's overcomplicating it to the extent that normal people and normal business people are sitting back and going, well, this is a bit of a waste of time. Because I don't think young people really care that much, because they're still drinking Starbucks. I don't think that the governments are, we need the governments and regulators to change everything, right? And it has to be a massive worldwide thing, or nothing's going to happen. And I looked at it and thought, you know, I recognize this. I've been in this situation probably 20 or 30 times in my life. And is it just me? And I'm kind of looking around me, and I thought, well, I doubt it's just me. But I felt compelled to do something that would make it easier for people to realize what the hell's going on around them, you know? And to see the reality from my point of view, that if you look at the very top strategic level as a global program, this is a humanity-wide thing, right? It isn't just about the environment, by the way. It's about working conditions for your supply chain. It's about healthcare and developing economies. It's about doing better stuff everywhere that we possibly can if we stand any chance of making humanity better off, okay? And that is not just about the environment, it's about everything, right? And if you look at that, then it's a top level thing. It's humanity wide business program or ecosystem program. And if you go down levels to the individual, it's me at my house in Berkshire or in Chiswick or wherever with a little plastic recycling box this big, and I'm being nagged to put my plastic bottles in it to save the planet. And then between those two extremes, I go, where is the level at which we can most likely affect these outcomes? Because that's where I'm going to aim. And it isn't the man or woman, putting plastic bottles in the box, albeit that's worthwhile, right? It's a start. It's an awareness start. And it certainly isn't United Nations saying to everybody, wagging their fingers, saying, you've got to do better. I went down to the level of governments and I thought, well, the governments and regulators form part of a three-pronged virtuous triangle when any change happens. So governments and regulators, businesses and business people, and consumers and customers. Yeah, that's the three points in the virtuous triangle that makes stuff happen. So you can't just rely on governments and regulators. You have to recognize that there needs to be a shift in consumers and customers, business customers too, and in the businesses and the business people. So my message then became focused on what do business people need to understand in order to recognize that this is a compelling thing to do. And that's the touch point that I can affect, because it's where I live, right? That's where all of us live. And so I decided if this is my change project, right? My little pet change project, saving the world, then let's equip business people with what they need, A, to recognize in the first place and to accept that there is a great shift happening.
Yeah,
right? Because it's easy to, you know, you can be forgiven for imagining that it's all going to be the same and to be ambivalent, but actually there is a great shift already happening, right? And I describe that quite unambiguously in the book, right? So that people can get to that point where they go, wow, actually, yes, this is real. Okay, this is a humanity-wide shift that is nearing a tipping point, which is an event that will cause disruption in the competitive markets of every company in every country around the world.
Hold that thought, Steve, because I think that's a great cliffhanger. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with Steve Sanders talking to us about this disruption